How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforming higher education. This message was paid for by EY.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is The Guardian.
I'm Matilda Bosley.
And I'm Jane Lee.
And today we're figuring out who screwed millennials out of affordable housing.
Are you going to ask me questions or?
Yeah.
So I went off and spoke to Judith Brett.
And then you edited into something.
Yeah.
Now, she's an emeritus professor of politics at La Trobe University. She's a member of the Order of Australia as well, and just generally quite a big deal. And I wanted to chat to her about the housing shortage.
Coming out of the war, there's a very acute housing shortage.
But not the one you're thinking of.
It was the end of World War II.
Soldiers coming home from the war.
The flags of freedom fly all over Europe.
People have put off marrying.
Couples, many of them separated for as much as 6 years, made up for lost time.
So there's all of a sudden this lot of young people forming families wanting houses. There aren't any houses.
Besides being an expert academically, Judith has a pretty direct link to this era too.
My name is Keith William Arnerman.
Her daughter's father-in-law was one of these soldiers who was returning home from the war.
I was born on the 11th of April, 1923.
And he is 100 years old.
The war was over and we got back and we were going to get back into normal life. But there was an immense problem with accommodation. People were doubling up in houses. In my case, my wife and I, for over 12 months or more, there were 13 people living in that three-bedroom house, sleeping in the hallway, on tables, everywhere. There was about three sessions at the table to eat.
You had to take it in shifts just for dinner.
Yes, oh, yeah, and one toilet, one bathroom.
Was there a roster at a certain point?
Yes, yeah. Yes, my word.
So what you've got is a population, if you like, that wants to get on with their life. There's been sacrifice for the national good, if you like, during the war. You know, government has to recognise the sacrifice that people made, and there's this massive housing shortage.
And the thing is, this housing shortage post-World War II, it's really similar to the one we're having today.
Is owning a house a goal of yours?
Probably not so much anymore, to be honest.
I already know I'm never going to own a house.
There just aren't enough homes for people to live in, and the ones that are available are way too expensive.
Yeah, it's a bit out of reach, I reckon, for most 22-year-olds.
It is kind of a dire, insane situation.
What is it that's going on that's causing this kind of divide?
Oh, I'm like, do we have time?
And look, the crisis we're living through now can often feel inevitable and inescapable. It feels like we're stuck in this cycle of unaffordability. But the truth is, there was a moment in time when Australia was united around the issue of affordable housing. And we know that governments are capable of lifting the country out of a housing crisis because, well, they've done it before. and all it took was just like a tiny, weeny, itsy-bitsy threat of an imminent communist revolution.
What? hold up. Go back.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is our great year of decision.
Why don't we go back to the year 1949?
Smith.
Are we for the socialist state with its subordination of the individual to the universal officialdom of government?
So that charming chap you just heard is Robert Menzies. He's kind of the founding father of the Liberal Party, if you will. And right after the Second World War, he's running for re-election to become Prime Minister again. He had a previous stint, then he got booted out. Now he's like, I'm back, baby.
In 1949, it's clear that a Labour vote is for the socialist objective and for nothing else.
And he has two main goals. Number one, classic, defeat communism.
In brief, socialism in Australia is an alien and deadly growth.
And two, make sure the Liberals win government.
Got it.
We must destroy its political power while there is yet time.
And Menzies reckons there's a way to kill those two birds with one stone. Make sure Australians own their own home.
The Liberal Party believes that every worthwhile Australian wants to own his own home, choose his own job, run his own business, make financial headway and bank his earnings where he wishes to bank them. The Liberal Party believes in and will maintain a full programme of socialism.
And it was very much his view that if we can get lower middle income people actually becoming homeowners, setting that as kind of the Australian dream.
This is Greg Jericho. He's a Guardian columnist and an economist at the Australia Institute.
We all call him Grogs.
And enabling people to achieve that, then they're going to be less likely to get radicalised or to think that, oh, we've got to look elsewhere.
And when you say so they don't look elsewhere, you mean look sort of directly towards down into their laps where the manifesto has just been sort of handed?
Yeah, I mean, it's in a sense trying to keep capitalism alive and keep the economy going and not descend into socialism, have people thinking that the entire system is stuffed.
And look, Jane, I think a really important part of this is that Menzies didn't want Australians to just have a place to live. He wanted Australians to be homeowners.
Privately.
He wanted to integrate that into their identity.
From Menzies' point of view, very much anti anything that smacked of communism or socialism, and certainly public housing had that sort of smell about it.
But those who by thrift and self-sacrifice establish homes and bring up families and add to the national pool of savings and hope someday to sit under their own vine and fig tree, owing nothing to anybody.
He wanted to turn every Australian away from what he saw as the scourge of communism and turn them into, and I quote, little capitalists.
The Department of Post-War Reconstruction estimates in the 10 years after the war, Australia will need 750,000 homes.
So the federal government just built more homes.
The plan is for modern houses with light and sunshine all around, with work made easy.
There was a housing commission established.
So there was Commonwealth money going into building houses, and there was Commonwealth money made available for private owners to borrow.
They opened up new suburbs to try and alleviate the shortage. Yes, Housing Commission.
You've got all these returned servicemen who are expecting houses, so there are war service loans.
And that's what Keith got. It helped him buy the house he's still living in today.
I bought this house for $5,000 nowadays.
Do you remember how much the interest was?
It was no more than 2%.
That hurts me deep inside.
Don't think it got any higher than 2%. Yeah. So it was nothing.
And it worked. The number of houses being built started to grow even faster than the population.
Within 10 years of the war ending, 300,000 new houses had been built. Yeah, turns out, and stay with me here, Jane, if you build more homes, people have more places to live.
Big enough for the house, a garden, a vegetable patch, a place for kids to play. To make Mum and Dad's life easier. And a spirit of optimism that seemed universal.
The desire to own a house and a little bit of land has been there since European settlement.
And there definitely is this view that if there ever was a moment where the Australian government really stepped up, you know, treated housing like the necessity that it is and poured federal money into giving Australians a place to live, it was this moment.
It wasn't a dream, if you like, that just got created in the 50s and 60s. It was just that from the middle 50s through the 60s, many more people could realise that dream.
But this moment doesn't last.
And the fact that that's now come to this screaming halt, I think, is really distressing to a lot of people.
Federal and state governments have stopped building homes in line with Australia's growing population, and decades of neglect have once again pushed Australia into the middle of a chronic housing shortage.
It's been looking bad, I reckon, for the last 20 years or more, as house prices have increased relative to the average wage, the average income.
Jane, can you guess how much Keith's home is worth now?
So, it's inner city Sydney.
Believe it or not, $2 million for this place. I said, oh, that must be ridiculous.
How do you feel about, you know, your great-great-grandchildren's chances of buying a home?
Absolutely impossible to buy a home. Any young people, unless there's some miracle, they will never be able to buy a home. You'll be an old lady by the time they overcome this problem. Mine, not even in your time.
So how did we go from a time when the government was helping people buy and build homes to, well, now?
John Howard had basically created a monster out of Robert Menzies' idea of owning a home.
A monster that started out having actually very little to do with housing. But it all comes back to then Prime Minister John Howard's economic ideology and firm belief that
the best way to get the economy going is to cut taxes, especially cut taxes on investment. So John Howard's like, this is what we have to do.
Howard was a self-proclaimed economic radical, and he had two huge influences, who in the 80s just happened to be at the helms of the most influential economies in the world.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem.
Ronald Reagan.
Government is the problem.
And Margaret Thatcher.
Let us never forget this fundamental truth. The state has no source of money other than the money people earn themselves. If the state
wishes... John Howard was a third-rate copy of Thatcher and her boys.
This is Yanis Varoufakis.
I was a refugee from Thatcher, okay?
You might remember him from episode one. He used to be the finance minister for the country of Greece.
I decided to come to Australia, even though I didn't know a single person in Australia, in 1987, when Thatcher won her third general election landslide. And Australia, when I arrived in 1988, was blissful compared to the Britain I was leaving behind, because Thatcherism had not reached its shores. And indeed, it was a very civilized place, Australia, up until John Howard came along. Essentially, he just copied the Thatcher playbook.
By playbook, Yanis means the economic ideology, neoliberalism.
Well, certainly Australian policymakers got a little bit consumed by this whole neoliberalism and this belief that the market will provide good outcomes, or at least better outcomes, and kind of ignored the fact that there was no free market. There is no free market.
John Howard spent years in opposition waging a war against taxes. And when he gets into office in 1996...
he's not so concerned about safety nets and equality, fairness. He's very much of the view that the market will deliver that.
He promised to reshape Australia in line with his economic idols by cutting one tax in particular, a tax often labelled as a tax on the rich.
Capital gains tax.
We will abolish Labor's capital gains tax. This tax discourages longer-term savings and investment, which are so desperately needed if Australia is...
John Howard, bless his little soul, bless his little dark soul, felt such hatred against capital gains tax.
What's the answer? The answer's simple. Get rid of it. Get rid of the capital gains tax. It's not a tax on the rich. In the end,
really, you can... basically draw a straight line back to 1999, the changes to the capital gains tax discount and the screwed overness of any generation to come after that.
Capital gains tax is basically the tax on the profit you make when you sell something for more than you bought it. So let's say I sell my house and I sell it for $300,000 more than I bought it for. I'm paying tax on all of that money as if it was my income.
You've made yourself very wealthy in this hypothetical scenario, Matilda.
Well, now that Howard is Prime Minister, he wants to make me even richer. Because if you simply abolish the capital gains tax, I get to pocket that 300 grand without paying a cent on it.
I suppose it's in accord with their sort of neoliberal notions that tax should be as low as possible.
This is Chris Evans, an emeritus professor from the University of New South Wales. And in his own words, he is...
probably amongst the more preeminent tax academics looking at capital gains tax.
Chris says that it was almost inevitable that the capital gains tax would be one of the Howard government's first targets.
And I suppose particularly because capital gains tax was a tax that hit the wealthy disproportionately. And so it was quite easy to seek to reduce the amount of tax coming from capital gains, particularly as it would benefit their constituency.
And 3 years into office, his plan finally starts to take shape.
John Howard wanted to change the complete direction that Australia had been taking.
This is Amy Remakis. She's a political reporter here at Guardian Australia.
And an elder millennial.
Now, the first step of Howard's plan is to outsource his policy proposals.
Howard and his right-hand man, Peter Costello, approach one of the biggest names in Australian business.
John Ralph. Who was, if you can think of a big Australian company, he had worked for it, headed for it, been on the board, been an executive.
They asked him to identify how cutting taxes will benefit big business.
He went for dinner at the lodge and was like, Howard, man, you've got to do a big review of the tax system.
Which they did.
And in a stroke of absolute creative genius, they called it, you guessed it,
the Ralph Review. That's a blast from the past.
When we look back and start putting all the pieces together, trying to figure out exactly what went wrong with housing in Australia, well, the Ralph Review is kind of the scene of the crime.
So the Ralph Review basically set Australia on a different course.
So it was the notion of trying to create a lower tax state, which was very much the sort of Reagan-Thatcher philosophy, which was picked up in Australia by the Howard government in the 90s.
But there's one problem. The views of the Howard government and the answers John Ralph is coming up with don't align with the Treasury or, well...
I think it's fair to say that the component members of the Ralph Review did not represent a broad spectrum of the views that were out there at the time.
All, shall we say, semi-intelligent economists, every government economic department all knew this is a total crock.
So the Ralph Review turns to a submission from another vested interest, the Australian Stock Exchange.
they brought in various advisors who, I suppose, reinforced their views as well.
The Australian Stock Exchange looks across the pond and hires a man from the very economic project that inspired Howard and Costello's low-tax philosophy in the first place.
I mean, one of the things that they became beholden to was
a particular guy called Alan Reynolds.
From the Reagan years, from America.
From a sort of quasi-right-wing think tank in the United States.
Alan Reynolds, at age 38, has already been offered two Reagan administration jobs, Assistant Secretary of Treasury and Assistant Director of Office of Management and Budget.
Who was, I think, at the end of the day, very influential in terms of his ideas about reducing tax could actually increase revenue, which intuitively it's very difficult to understand how that can be the case.
Plenty of doubts have already been expressed about Reagan's economics, but in the cluttered Chicago office of Alan Reynolds, the message is clear and uncluttered by any pessimism.
And Alan Reynolds comes back with the answers they want to hear.
I suppose it's a question of bias confirmation as much as anything. These were people who were singing their tune.
The Ralph Review runs with Reynolds' idea. They recommend a 50% reduction on the tax people pay when selling their assets.
A half-price discount.
I have to say, I suspect, you know, that that was the background agenda all the time, that this was neoliberalism pushing for a smaller state rather than a larger state, therefore a smaller tax take rather than a larger tax take.
How would you react if I told you that his Twitter profile photo was him standing next to Margaret Thatcher?
It would not surprise me in the slightest. I would imagine that he would regard Thatcher as being an idol.
So if all of these Australian economists are saying this is a bad idea, why does Reynolds' proposal to cut the capital gains tax carry so much weight? Why do Howard and Costello listen to him?
It's the cultural cringe. We have amazingly been open to listening to the views of people from America purely because they worked in an American administration. So the fact that he worked in the Reagan administration, that gave him a kudos that put him above Australian economists in the eyes, at least, of the Howard government.
But when the Aussie economists got wind of this, let's just say that once again, they were not jazzed. In fact, our mate, Chris Evans, was actually one of the first in line to fight it.
How would you prefer to be addressed? Professor
Chris.
Or...?
No, Chris is fine.
This new tax plan ends up going through a big Senate committee, basically to decide if it's a good idea or not.
Yes, thank you. And thanks for the opportunity of presenting to the committee making the submission.
So in the summer of 1999, Evans gathers his research, packs his briefcase and prepares to face off with the country's lawmakers.
My sole focus is on the capital gains tax provisions and the proposed changes to those provisions, and particularly as they relate to individuals.
I was strongly arguing that it wouldn't, as they had suggested, lead to a freeing up of economic activity and a generation of far greater tax revenues.
But you still don't believe it'll be effective?
No.
But would actually benefit the wealthy disproportionately and would lead to lower tax revenues overall.
So you were sort of the ultimate party pooper at the fun neoliberal party.
But not the only one.
And I thought, It's interesting to hear that Alan Reynolds is involved in this. Let's have a look at his CV. And I asked my staff to drag out his CV.
There was another really loud voice speaking out against Howard's tax cuts by disguise, but this time it was coming from inside Parliament House.
And where was Alan Reynolds at the scene of the crime for Reaganomics? You look up his career details, he was in the heart.
Guess whose voice that was?
Mark Latham. Yeah.
So here we are, relying not on our professional advisor in Treasury or Finance or any other part of the Australian Public Service. We're relying on a bloke who was part of the most discredited and unsuccessful economic experiments in the history of the Western world. And it is a shame that this Parliament is using a corrupted process to make policy.
Yeah, I constantly forget that he used to be the leader of the Labour Party before the whole One Nation saga of it all.
Right, but this was the late 90s, right? So back then he would have just been a backbencher for the Labour Party.
It's a bit like putting Hannibal Lecter in charge of the mortuary. Hannibal Lecter in charge of the mortuary. That's the corrupted process by which this government is running tax policy.
But despite Chris coming to the committee with his briefcase filled with facts and reason,
and Mark Latham's blunter approach,
Howard's new tax policy sails through Parliament with the support of Labor. How did you feel when the news came through that, no, they've gone the Ralph way?
Well, I suppose the short answer is not surprised, but very upset. I think the Senate had already made its mind up in terms of where it sat, and that was a majority coalition committee.
So this plan, like Howard's plan to start reshaping Australia's economy and the first step to cut taxes, is it successful?
If by success you mean that the wealthy can become much wealthier, then yes, it was very successful. If you measure success in terms of a more equitable society, it's very difficult to see how those neoliberal, Thatcherite, Reaganistic ideas of the 80s, which did spread through Australasia in the late 80s, early 90s, it's very difficult to see how they've led to a more successful society, led to a fairer society.
So we know that these tax cuts make the system less fair. They mean that the wealthy are paying less tax when selling their assets.
Exactly. And this is where we come back to housing. Your house is probably the biggest asset you own.
And that's why these tax changes really set fire to Australia's housing market.
Because, you see, when the newly legislated capital gains tax discount is unleashed into Australian society, it quickly finds a new best friend.
Let's move on to negative gearing.
Negative gearing.
Negative gearing.
Negative gearing law.
Negative gearing.
Negative gearing is this odd little quirk of our tax system that had been laying relatively dormant for decades. But once the capital gains tax discount woke it up,
that interacted with negative gearing in a rather hideous way.
Together, they started wreaking havoc.
I don't know about you, Jane, but despite like always hearing the term negative gearing and knowing generally that it's something that contributes to housing prices, I never totally understood exactly what it was.
But you figured it out now?
I indeed did, I think. So, basically, you know how you can make tax deductions?
Yes.
Well, the same principle applies to investments. So using housing as an example for obvious reasons, let's say that along with my normal job, I own an investment property. And over the course of the year, I got 50 grand in rent from my tenant. But it also cost me 50 grand of property expenses, like mortgage repayments and council rates. And I have made no profit at all. Well, then I obviously don't have to pay any tax on that investment property.
So if the person paying rent isn't covering your mortgage, that's fine?
And that's pretty normal all across the world. What's weird about the Australian system is that it doesn't stop there.
Unlike most countries, if you're losing money on your investment, you get to claim that against your normal salary as well, so you're able to drastically cut the amount of tax that you're paying.
Because you can use negative gearing to get a tax discount.
And that process of running an investment property at a loss in order to reduce your overall tax is called, you guessed it, negative gearing.
And while you might be losing money now, the value of your investment property will go up so much that you'll cancel out any of the losses that you made when you sell.
It's a capital gain and you're going to get a nice discount, basically a 50% discount.
And of course, you're only going to have to pay half of the tax on your profit anyway.
You use negative gearing to reduce your tax while you own the property, and then you use the discount from capital gains tax when you sell the property.
So what Groggs is saying is that I can get a sweet little tax break every year and then an even bigger tax break when I sell.
You're laughing. So great.
Well, in that case, I may as well buy another investment property and keep that ball rolling.
You, in a sense, were getting a tax rort two ways.
And that's exactly what property investors are doing. They're now willing to spend more on the properties they buy.
So in a sense, you had this wonderful combination where suddenly it really made sense to speculate.
Which, of course, makes house prices rise even faster. Which then makes the combination of negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount even more profitable, which means investors are willing to spend even more, which makes house prices rise even faster.
You really could not think of a better combination of two tax policies that are going to set fire to a housing market to actually turn it from being a market designed to give people a home that hopefully will go up in value or at least give them some wealth that they can retire on to being something that now we can actually enrich ourselves by.
And so the vicious cycle begins.
This incredible five-bedroom family home, we're selling!
Buying something.
950 is the bid.
Selling it.
1,000,089 now.
Buying something more.
At 1,601 the bid.
Selling it.
2,102,000.
Buying something.
At 2,255, at 2,255, 2,255.
Buying something more.
3,440, third. Final time, any better offers.
And this is why, despite the many interlinked reasons that housing is so unaffordable, it does kind of all come back to Howard and Costello. No nuance, just one sentence. Who screwed millennials at the end of the day?
I wish it was even something that I had to think about. John Howard and Peter Costello basically destroyed housing ownership for generations to come.
Because, as Groggs says, this is the moment in time Australians start to see housing in a completely different way.
You can see a completely sort of different tack to what we had under Menzies, where it's this thing of let's make little capitalists out of each other, but it was capitalists in that sense of you're a homeowner, you have done it yourself through your graft and being able to work hard and own your own home to... Now I'm turning everyone into little speculators, little investors.
Menzies' little capitalists turn into little conservatives.
It's kind of twisted, really, when you think about it.
And in turn, the Australian dream was somewhat transformed into the Australian nightmare.
It's kind of horrible.
Menzies was not supporting home ownership for your second house.
This is Judith Brett again, and she says under Howard and Costello, housing in Australia changes from a place you call home, you know, a place to live and grow and raise your family, into an asset.
Under John Howard, that the idea of housing becoming an asset and an investment started to take off.
John Howard and Peter Costello essentially built the housing market we know today. And unfortunately, that's a housing market primarily designed to make more wealth for those who already have it.
It's a very critical shift in outlook, and it's one that has had massive repercussions for home ownership.
And I'm assuming this impacts young people far more than it does the other generations.
Yeah. What it really enabled was to create investors out of the baby boomers because they were the ones who owned the homes, they were the ones who had the equity in their homes, and they were the ones who John Howard was very much appealing to because he saw them as the major voting block make them feel like they can enrich themselves, then they're going to keep voting for me. And so what it ends up being is just making life better for those who start in positions of power and wealth, and in a sense widens those gaps even more.
There's no doubt, you know, in terms of distributions of wealth, in the last 20, 30 years, we've seen the wealthy become far wealthier and the poor become far poorer.
At this point in time, we kind of know what the problems are, but still, this housing bubble grows. Nothing bursts. Nothing seems to change.
You've got these policies that were introduced by John Howard when the boomers ruled. They were the major voting bloc. You won the boomers, you won elections. And that was, you know, the most cynical way to think about it.
You see, while Howard may not have set out to dramatically increase the values of people's homes back in 1999, as the years went on and the wealth of homeowners skyrocketed, he starts to wear this property boom on his sleeve.
He once famously said that no one came up to him on the street and complained about the value of their house going up.
The wealth of the homeowners starts pulling them away and their interests away from the people who don't own a home.
And it starts to become politically difficult to do anything other than help homeowners increase their wealth.
So nobody wants to introduce policies that could potentially lower the price of that property, because you buy the property hoping that it is going to grow in wealth and then your wealth will grow. And if some government comes along and says, hey, we're going to get rid of these, you know, tax policies, everyone freaks out because suddenly they're looking at their property prices going down and going, but I had plans for that money. And so they fight against it.
And so now the politicians will say, well, you know, two-thirds of people own their houses or are paying them off, one-third doesn't. So where's the majority?
And so far, no government, local, state or federal, has been able to stand up and say, we're just going to do this so that future generations can actually just have a house. They can just have a roof over their head. Nothing fancy.
Amy says there's never really been a tax gift that Australians have been given that's then been taken away.
We hold on to those very, very tightly, not just because, you know, of the people who are using them, but for the people who might be able to use them down the track.
Because, as Yanis says,
wealth reproduces itself. If you have $1,000, it's really very difficult to make another 100 out of it. If you've got $1 billion, you don't need to do anything. It will simply breed more billions. That is a fact of capitalism, especially when it comes to real estate.
And look, we should say it's not just old people and not even just pre-Howard era home buyers who are benefiting from this fact of capitalism. Some young people will also be able to afford a home. But this system means that it really, really helps if you're able to borrow from the bank of mum and dad to get that deposit in the first place.
So if for some historical accident you own land, quite bits of it, you don't need to do anything. You're going to get much, much richer and much faster than the average struggler will, the average entrepreneur, the average person who actually contributes things is going to make far less wealth than you will, even though you're not doing anything.
Yeah, if you have wealthy parents, that's the single biggest factor determining whether you can access the property market right now.
And to be honest, I can kind of understand why most boomers, most people's parents took advantage of this. They were never told investing in the housing market might make their children's lives harder.
Most Australians were told it was the best way to save for their retirement, that it was the best way to provide financial security for their families.
I know people in Australia, I have lots of friends, who struggled for years to get their foot on the property ladder. And the way they managed to do this was they could buy a house in which they could live with their family because they didn't have the money. So they bought a small apartment, which they rented out. They got a huge mortgage for it. And they used the negative gearing in order to reclaim some tax back from that. And after 20 years of struggling this way, they managed through negative gearing to get their foot on the ladder and maybe buy a house in which they could actually live.
Despite the fact rising prices are shutting some of the most vulnerable Australians out of affordable and safe housing, and everything we see keeps pointing to the fact this crisis is getting worse and worse, the message that most Australians keep hearing is that increasing your wealth through the property market is still a good thing.
Now, if you go to them and you say, I'm going to stop negative gearing now because it is madness, they will know what you mean. I used negative gearing for the last 20 years. I suffered with it in order to manage to get this home. So it's political suicide to propose the right policy.
For decades, fixing the tax system or really doing anything to slow the exponential boom of property prices has been a political no man's land.
This really is a political hot potato.
Who would want to touch it?
Those with assets tend to be the wealthy. The wealthy tend to have far greater influence and far greater ability to defend their positions than those in society who have less voice, less wealth, less influence. So I think it's a combination of that sort of the politics of tax along with the deeply embedded position that the wealthy are going to defend at all costs.
And while the politics of tax has made governments hesitant to tiptoe into the no man's land that is negative gearing reform, there was one person who kind of saw this all coming.
My name is Alan Reynolds, and I'm appearing to testify on the subject of capital gains taxation in Australia and the United States.
You know, the guy that came up with the whole capital gains tax discount in the first place. The guy Howard and Costello used to sell this entire idea. Well, he actually had some things to say about negative gearing at the very same Senate hearing as Chris Evans back in 1999.
Can I invite you, Mr. Reynolds, to make a short opening statement, after which the committee will have questions for you?
Sure.
Alan Reynolds wanted Australia to get rid of negative gearing way before house prices started to skyrocket.
Negative gearing may in fact be a problem. It's certainly one that we don't have because it's illegal.
How does Alan Reynolds feel about the role that he's played in Australia's housing market today?
I emailed him several times, no reply.
Thank you. I understand it's a holiday there. Enjoy it.
Thank you. Well, yes. There's never a holiday in economics.
We'll be right back.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghigher-education. This message was paid for by EY.
Now, the only other attempts at rolling back the tax concessions that are really driving the housing crisis came from Labor during the 2016 and 2019 elections.
When a whole generation of Australians feel shut out of the housing market, the great Australian dream of your own home. If you want a housing affordability plan, that's more than just get rich parents. Vote Labor.
They were just sort of going to be correcting some tax changes that had essentially hurt home ownership. Instead, it was all painted as, oh, this is going to destroy home values.
people lost their minds over it.
The residential building industry doesn't like what it's hearing. Tinkering with tax breaks would reduce investment in housing.
How dare you take away this thing that I was counting on to help my retirement?
Your home will be worth less. Your investment property will be worth less. And rents will rise. It's exactly the wrong time to restrict negative gearing.
But overstated or not, the message Labor takes away is that house prices are sacred.
So we've got people who literally are thinking about themselves and their own situation rather than thinking about what is this doing to the fabric of Australian society? What is this doing to generations down the track? What is this doing to my own children?
And Labor's big strategy to make housing affordable again fades away.
But as an election looms,
the coalition is already going, are you going to rule out any changes to the family home tax arrangements? And that is a huge scare campaign that's already running around the wings of the federal parliament.
And as a result, at the moment, there is no moves to change these tax arrangements that really were the cause of the problem.
Now, to be fair, Labor does have a housing policy.
Housing Australia Future Fund, I think it is, the HAF.
They want 30,000 new homes to be built over the next 5 years.
Not by building homes directly, though, by working with state governments and providing incentives for private developers.
Whenever you hear about housing, it's all about sort of, maybe we can bring back some public housing, or we can, you know, bring in incentives for the private sector to build more housing.
And while 30,000 new homes might sound like a lot on paper, it doesn't really make much of a dent when you look at the sheer scale of this crisis.
Australia has once again found itself in just the position we were in after the Second World War. There just aren't enough homes for people to live in.
Australia's population has grown by over 7 million people since Howard's tax concessions really took hold back in the early 2000s, but the number of places people can actually live has only increased by 3 million.
And that's a huge gap, which I'm sure only hurts housing affordability. So why can't the government just do what Menzies did in the 50s? Why can't we just build more homes?
Because the federal government essentially just goes, housing isn't our problem, housing is the state's problem, and we're going to try and push the states to do more. We're giving money to the states to try and turn around affordable housing. We're giving money to the states to tell them to increase their supply of housing. And the states are like, yeah, we're definitely looking at that. Yeah, we're totally doing more. Look at this field. We're going to turn this into houses and we're going to definitely meet those targets. I don't see any evidence that we're actually going to meet those targets.
We're now at the point where potentially it's kind of a big crisis. Can we afford small targets?
No, we can't. Because people do not have houses. People are losing hope that they're actually going to, you know, not even thinking about climbing out of the economic class that they were born into, but actually just even maintain that economic class and not slip backwards. You have people who are worried about how they're going to put food on the table for at least one meal, let alone three.
I've got a daughter, she's 20, and she's saying, well, I'm never going to own a home. How am I going to own a home? There is a vast chunk of people under the age of, say, 45 who don't own a home, who, when they were 20, would have expected by now that they would own a home, and they don't. And once you get to that point, you can't keep sort of saying to yourself, oh, I guess it's just I need a better job, or I've been unlucky. You kind of know that it's because the system is completely rigged against you.
How do we fix a system that has such consequences because we're so deep in it?
Look, no one has come up with an answer for it yet.
And that's because, as we've just heard, the answers to this problem are hard. There is no easy solution.
This is not going to take a quick fix. It's impossible. It is going to take whole of government thinking from council to the federal government, and also just a big push from millennials and younger generations of just going, you know what, fix this or we're going to burn this place down.
And so maybe in the meantime, we should start addressing some of the other problems too.
Does it mean that we actually start having proper tenant rights in Australia because we've already reached the point where people are going to be renting for their entire lives, which is not something that we have seen in previous generations? So does that mean that we actually have to start treating investment properties as the tenant's home rather as a way of building somebody else wealth?
Because if we do nothing, things are only going to get worse.
Without some intervention, which is going to mean some pain, we are going to be talking not only about this issue of not being able to afford a home in another 10, 20 years or so, we are going to be experiencing the very real destruction of the social fabric that holds Australia together. And we're already seeing that. We're already seeing rising rates of inequality. And so unless we actually seriously address this and start looking at supply and start looking at reforming the tax system, not because it's going to solve everything overnight, but because it's just fair, it's equitable, we are going to entrench these problems.
But the thing about housing and the inequality it entrenches is that this is just one symptom of a much broader problem facing young people.
And it's a pretty big, glaring one, but it's also all of those little financial pressures that have built up over the millennial generation, all of those nicks and cuts to social programs, all of the losses that we've seen in Medicare, in education.
Even though we know that, you know, you don't have to pay it off right away, you only pay it off once you reach a certain income, it is still this large sum of money kind of hanging over you.
Not only are we at a disadvantage when it comes to buying a home for ourselves and creating a financial safety net, millennials and Gen Z are also saddled with a disproportionate amount of debt that our parents never had to pay.
And I think there is quite a lot of anxiety about that, particularly because we're at a stage where, you know, young people are already struggling with things like the cost of living, with their rents, and it's just another debt, really, that you've got in the back of your mind. So I think there is a sense of anxiety about HECS debt.
But that's for next time
on Who Screwed Millennials Out of Affordable Education? This episode was presented by me, Jane Lee.
And me, Matilda Bosley. I also reported this episode with Miles Herbert.
It was produced by Joe Koning and Miles Herbert, who's also the series producer.
Sound design by Joe Koning, mixing by Michelle Macklem.
Our executive producer is Miles Martignoni and commissioning editor is Gabrielle Jackson.
And thanks to Malcolm Farnsworth and AustralianPolitics.com for helping source some of the archive for this episode.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.